Okay, I'm speaking with Derek DeKirchhoff on June 17th, 2014, and we're going to discuss the five or six schools of media ecology based on an essay I did 12 years ago.
You've added one.
Yes, you haven't read. You'll see that at the end. There is one. What we're doing now is the sixth school of media ecology, what we do in Maui. So we begin with what I call Act One. And let's see, what should give the title of the essay. The essay is called Literate/Aesthetic Cliche Probes in the American Classroom Without Walls. And I begin with Act One with Barry Nevitt. And the reason I start with Barry Nevitt is that there was the first meeting of the World Future Society, or maybe it was just called the Future Society, and it was in Toronto. It was around the summer of 1980. It was 1980, and I think it was the summer. And Marshall couldn't speak. You know, he was in the aphasic condition from his stroke in September 26, 1979. And so they were going to give him an award as, you know, the key original futurist or whatever, honor him. So Barry Nevitt is at the conference. He's got a booth. He's got a little table. And he's selling his new book, The ABC of Prophecy. And it has the tetrad in it, and he has the decad. He's developed 10 levels. And he meets a lot of interesting people, including Dennis Murphy at from Concordia University. And Dennis is pretty impressed with Barry's understanding of McLuhan, so he starts inviting Barry to Concordia in Montreal all through the 80s, early 90s. And that brings Barry into an academic level for, you know, the baby boomer generation or younger, maybe Generation X, that he did not have access to. So many people encountered McLuhan through Barry in the 80s, at least in the university scenes of Montreal. So that's why I begin with Barry, and he gets he's the only one sort of talking pretty intelligently about Marshall. Now, you knew Barry. Would you agree with me that Barry understood Marshall's work pretty good?
Oh, yes, he did. But he competed with Marshall.
That's right, yes.
And, he did.
You know, Mark Stewart tells a story when they went on David Frost, I think, in 1972 to promote Take Today, the executive's dropout. Barry sounded like the Mad Hatter of, you know, whatever story that was in. And he's chattering away a little too excited and, like, talking over Marshall and just loving being in the spotlight. It was his first time. And I recall that. That's the way Barry was.
Could you explain to me why Barry didn't basically emerge really among the general discourse on McLuhan? I mean, even though Barry wrote four books, all of them perfectly tuned to Marshall,
yeah,
you never hear about him anywhere.
I think that's because in the period 81 to 86, nobody cared about Marshall. Nobody cared about Barry's books.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was hanging around him then, and he was he named me his archivist, so I got copies of all his books. He did some obscure company called Butterworth. They put out The Communication Ecology in 1982, a nice hardcover book, well made, and no one bought it. Nobody was interested. Remember, this is that period where you guys couldn't even get the coach house open again. Remember, you and David Olson?
Of course I do. Yeah, it was a job.
Yeah, so that's 83 when that starts. Mm-hmm. And when Nelson and I started the fun fair in May 83, once you guys had gotten it open around February 83, you and David Olson, we featured Barry Nevitt. But nobody was coming around. There were a few people from the street or whatever, but no big deal. Certainly, I didn't see you or William Irwin Thompson or anybody else interested in his books. So I think that he represented the older McLuhan, the McLuhan that people almost didn't want to deal with anymore. And they were looking.
Yes, but no, there was something else. McLuhan just did not paint a very good nice picture, or did not, so kind of encourage people to pay too much attention to Barry. The way he was dismissing Barry was sometimes pretty awful. It's the way he dismissed Eric. I mean, I think of all the people that I've seen Marshall being heavy with, It was with Barry and Eric, and then everybody else. He had a fling at it. You know, kind of. He would be critical of other people, including myself. But I never saw anybody as quite as martyrized than Barry. So then, sort of Barry comes after, and the feeling you have is like, you know, he's rehashing Marshall. But when you read him, as I have now done because of your wonderful work there, you realize that he's probably he's condensed McLuhan more than Marshall is already condensed.
That's right, and he actually gets it correct. He understands the roots of Finnegan's Wake,
yes.
And he lays it out the way no other translator had done, because he knew it.
It is true, and for an engineer, that's quite a feat.
Right, that's right. But he stopped
really?
Being... He built the Global Village, you know, with that company, that Norwegian company, whatever it was,
back
in the 60s in South America. He put up all the utilities, or he was the engineer running a lot of that. And then when he heard about Marshall in 1964, I think his wife bought him Understanding Media for Christmas, he immediately went down to the center in early 65 and was dumbfounded that there was someone articulating what he had kind of dimly noticed. He had noticed the effects a bit. I mean, he was, you know, that he was in the Soviet Union in 1933.
That's amazing.
Yeah, he got around, and he was an intellectual, and he was interested in all these things. So he was impressed with Marshall as someone who was looking at the effects. So Barry stopped being an engineer pretty well at that point, and just trying to be part of Marshall's scene. And he eventually gets to write for the Dew Line in 1968, and then he does the Take Today, which took about 4 years to make that book. So he was considered competent enough to be a co-writer, even though co-writers always had problems with Marshall, like Wilford Watson. But he stayed on.
Yeah.
One thing about Barry, he put up with the niggling and the put-downs. He knew, he just ignored that and stayed there. And so he witnessed, as I said to you, he may have been the originator with Marshall of the Tetrad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he was there when Eric was away in Madison, Wisconsin. So he and Marshall figured that out.
Wait a minute. That is trying to ring a very faint bell. How did they talk about the Tetrad? Did they talk about the Tetrad together? Yes, they did. I can't remember specifically. I don't have a precise memory of where or how, but I do have the memory that I was a witness to them discussing things in tetradic form, because I think that was probably even my own first exposure to it, and my doubting it. I actually doubt it less now than I did when it started. But
yeah, you were there in 72, translating, right?
That's right.
Yeah, so you would have been around. When I went there in 74 with Cynthia, your old friend Cynthia Lozier, summer of 74, I was downstairs. The coach house was open. It was a Saturday afternoon, and I could hear Barry and Marshall talking, and Marshall's telling Barry, okay, let's call it inflation as pregnancy. And they were going on saying that. I always remember that thing. Then they came down, and we talked to them. But they were doing a short version of Take Today, which ended up being serialized in a magazine called Modern Office Procedures. That's as far as they could get with it. They did a really good, you know, brief version of Take Today, which is a long book, in this magazine.
What do you think of Take Today?
Oh, I think it's a great book. It's a very important book. And as
Marshall sort of tossed it.
Oh, he tossed everything. He wasn't interested in being a writer or book. He was living in the present. None of this stuff was what really Marshall was interested in. He just did it because he had to look busy, right? Look a busy. But he was using that to find out, to keep in touch with people, to talk to people. He needed Barry Nevitt to talk to him. But you know what? I have the part of Take Today Barry gave me as his archivist. I have a huge section that was cut out by Harcourt Brace, whatever, that the publisher, called Management by Prevision. It takes the 10 Thunders of Finnegan's Wake and applies it to management. It's a huge, amazing 100 pages.
Oh, I'd love to read that.
Right. Now, that's important, that thing. And that
was written by both of them?
Yes. Largely it's written by Barry, because he would Marshall would just mouth off and Barry would write it down. Then go home. He would take notes and he'd write it up and then come back a day or so later and Marshall would read it and say, yeah, that's good enough. Okay, put that in there?
Marshall then also said that he just muddled the whole thing. That's what he accused poor Barry of having done.
Yes, but you notice years later, in the late 70s, he started praising the book because he noticed people, smart McLuhanites, liked it. So he dropped his complaint about it. That happened later.
It should be translated. I tried to translate it for a while, putting it together in different ways. Marshall wanted me to do it, but I had to give up. It was really too difficult. I would have loved it to be cleanly listed in categorical stuff, just like any old Cartesian would. And it was like all over the place.
Right. It was too much for translation.
Oh, but it was all over the place, too. It had puns which didn't come off too well sometimes.
Yeah.
I don't know. I had problems with it. But I've read stuff about management in McLuhan, and I'd have to recover it. But it's where he talks about the economy in a very interesting, very generalized way. I probably can put my hands on it again, and I'll tell you what it is.
Right. Well, what I liked about it is it's the book that he deals with post-Watergate realities, mafias, CIA control of media and corporations. That's what they're talking about. Now, there is a great, you know, the expirations he did for the University of Toronto graduate in the 60s, like from 60. You got most of them?
I don't have most of them. I think I have about 11 or 12.
Okay, well, I have all of them. And I got them when I dropped into their office in 77 and was lucky. They were kind of throwing them out, but I got them. I've been told by Gary Ganosko the library doesn't even have all of them. So anyways, in one of the last issues, 1971, Marshall had, and that's 71, they're working on Take Today. So it's a Take Today theme. He says, the title of the article is The Hijacking of Cities, Nations, and Planets. Think of that.
Wow.
Hijacking
of
cities, nations, planets. And when you know that article, you see that's what they're doing in Take Today. We're talking about the hijacking, how management can rip off the whole global theater. And management is an elite that he said created the huge patterns at the speed of light. They would think the big patterns. The Kissingers or Brzezinski, they say, okay, there is a Cold War. The Cold War isn't over. You know what I mean? They would keep these big things going. And they take on those guys. And one of the symbols of who they take on is Peter Drucker, who they call the man who came to listen. Not the dialogue, the man who came to listen, meaning coming to observe, and not participate.
Take advantage.
Yeah, take advantage.
And not participate, for sure, yeah.
And then Drucker,
and
Drucker did that.
Here's a sidebar. What happened to Cynthia Lucie?
I don't know. She disappeared a few years later. I think she went back to New Brunswick. I think she was from New Brunswick, and I think she got married. But she was more involved with a friend of mine, and my friend broke off from her, and then my friend got married to someone else, so there was no means of keeping in touch
with
Cynthia.
Was that when she was working at the library of Ryerson?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And she also had a store. Remember she had an antique clothing store? Do you remember that?
I don't remember that. I don't think I knew her then. She had just, when I met her, she was a friend of her. I can see her, but I can't remember her name.
Right.
Who herself was going out with a poet who was horribly pretentious. I mean, horribly poet. I mean, he was like your classic poet that you would find in some English movie,
Right, right.
Some British movie. Very, very stuck up. And then he had asked me one day to read the French version of poems by Baudelaire that he had translated into English. And I was reading with tremendous gusto.
Yes.
And he was like, despised me so much. Because all, poetry for him was something that you read as, you read poetry.
Right.
You didn't say it.
And you could read it. You understood the French.
Oh, for sure I did.
Yeah. So you could read it better than he could.
Well, for the French anyway, but he was reading his own translation in English.
Yeah, is he a well-known poet? Do you know who you're talking about?
Oh, yeah. Again, this is bad, and I took a flight. Every time I fly,
Well, the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, whatever those guys were, They hung around McLuhan, Steve McCaffrey,
sure.
And it would be one of those guys?
Bill Dutton and...
And B.B.?
No, what? It was B. Pinnacle.
Yeah.
And the fourth.
Not those. Not those guys.
I don't think so. No. These actually were quite fun.
Yeah.
They were actually interesting poets, and they were doing in Canada what Le Amour du Bruit and the various kind of protesting poets had done in the streets of Paris.
Right. There was Milton somebody. Milton was the
yes,
older guy.
Yes.
And there might have been a guy. There was Robert somebody who...
Milton Acorn?
Yeah, I think that's his name, Milton Acorn.
Yeah.
And there was Robert somebody, Robert Priest. He was a younger guy, and he went on to make music. Okay, so I'm looking at Barry's ABC of Prophecy, subtitled Understanding the Environment, and he told me that he couldn't put the tetrad in. He wasn't allowed to do the tetrad, okay? You know.
Why was it? What, the marshal had said he couldn't?
Yes, the McLuhan estate, you know, what's her name? Mady Molinaro would not.
Oh, okay.
Because the tetrad wasn't out yet. It wasn't going to be out for another 8 years, 7 or 8 years when Laws of Media.
Yeah.
So what he did, he put it in the middle of what he called the new decad. He made a decad, a 10-leveled thing.
Huh. And where I don't have that here, of course. Like, what are the 10 levels?
First is monad. That's figure ground, just figure slash ground. The dyad is center margin, center slash margin, and center without margins. All right? That's visual acoustic space, you could say. The triad is, what's he got here, N? What's that stand for? N is nature. So he has big capital N for nature, capital N for, I guess that would be first nature, slash small N, which is probably technology, second nature. Seeing what it is. Then he has, now this is on the triad. Then he has hardware slash software and sensory impact slash sensory closure. Those three things make up the triad.
S-I-S-C.
Right, S-I-S-C. And then the tetrad is front spin, back spin, cliched archetype, and chiasmus. So he actually has the tetrad there, but it's mixed up within the decad. It's one section. It's not highlighted. So
yeah, I have to say I can't understand all of it. I mean, I know well, obviously, monads, and I know a lot about the figure ground, the center margin. That's easy.
Right. But the triad is a nature. Let's see. He says, which aspects are thesis, antithesis, and synthesis in Hegelian or Marxian dialectics? Is there a transformation of quantity into quality or vice versa in progress? Does it recall the ancient trivium of grammar, logic, and rhetoric, or rhythm, rhyme, and reason? Do its concepts eliminate all percepts? What is its relation with nature, capital N, as an extension of man, that's EOM, and then nature, without a capital N, I think that would be of which man is an extension, so that's the technology is nature. What is the hardware-software relation in its process of etherealization? What are its material, mental, and social sensory closure in relation to its sensory impact in both high definition and low definition? That's the pattern from Project 69 in 1960, you know, the report he did for the national broadcasters in the States.
Yeah.
And he says, what are its material relations when entering into the environment? The reason I bring this up, who else could do this? Nobody. This is why I'm saying Barry is the first to jump on the stage of the Global Theater as the inheritor of the McLuhan mantle. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
That's my point. And he put out the Communication Ecology in 1982, published by Butterworth, and he had all the main texts, the core texts for understanding McLuhan, you know, the Edward T. Hall, I guess it is, and everybody else. It's all gathered there properly, so it's a backgrounder to McLuhan's roots. And who else was doing that in 81, 82? Nobody. Nobody had that.
No, you're right.
So I'm saying that he's act one of the McLuhan meme, so he's the one who carries the ball when no one cared. But what's sneaking up on everybody is act two, and that's Severo Latrinje at Columbia University, who is starting, and he told me that he, you know, the little semiotext booklets. You could always buy them at Page's Bookstore in Toronto. They were modeled after the medium as a massage paperback. He saw the medium as a massage paperback as something that you could carry around in your purse and that, and he wanted to redo that with his books and bring in all his French buddies, you know, Barthes, Baudrillard, Foucault, Lyotard, Deleuze and Guattari, Virilio, all of them.
Mm-hmm.
So he jumps on, you know, in the global theater, he gets attention with all these McLuhanites who nobody knows are influenced by McLuhan. And so Semiotext Text takes off, and because it's centered in New York and Columbia University, I'm calling that the New York School of Media Ecology.
What surprises me is that I didn't know about Lothringer.
Yeah, you knew. I know you knew Baudrillard because you have met that conference in Paris in 1983 or 84.
Yes. No, Baudrillard I knew. I know all of these guys, including Derrida, who you don't mention, but who didn't actually.
He doesn't make Semiotext. For some reason, Severa doesn't publish him.
That's right. But in any case, it's interesting that Lothringer. And what happened to Lothringer? He was a professor.
I think he's still doing it. And I've kept in touch with him, and I think he lives in Baja, California now.
Ah.
But he's still, you know, all of Semiotext got bought up by MIT. So MIT distributes it now.
When did he stop doing it?
Beg your pardon?
When did Lothringer stop doing Mediatext?
Well, when you read the later parts of this long essay, see, what I say is that in the 1990s, what I call the Android meme, which is virtual reality, artificial intelligence, just the media taking on a life of its own, or the Internet, in the 90s, McLuhan is replayed, beginning with with Wired Magazine. So every school is replayed, the five acts that I lay out. So you have Barry gets republished. Now, Severo Lestrange, because by the early 90s, he and his partner, Chris Kroos, who's an artist and writer, novelist, they decide that all the people he popularized, French theory in the 80s, now are part of academia, and they're not interested in the fact that they are successfully taught in academia. So they go to making fiction. They drop from making theory to doing fiction, and with his partner, Chris Kroos, they start the, I think it's called the Foreign Agent series. So that's their reaction to the Android meme. And so they do that for years, but I think they're still doing it, but I haven't talked to Severa in about 4 years, so I don't know. Now, here's an interesting thing, just to put it on the record. In 2008, Severa calls me up, and I just got here to Maui, and he says, Bob, I'm reading Understanding Media. That's a good book. Now, here's a guy promoting all these people. He's so involved with the French theory people, he never read McLuhan. I think he knew they were influenced by McLuhan in some way, but he had no awareness of it. But still, it doesn't matter. They are the post-McLuhan media ecologists in many ways, and I show, since I can't put every quote by McLuhan in there for copyright reasons, I'd have to go to every publisher and get their permission. I just describe where it is in the book, and I show every one of those thoughts of Foucault, Baudrillard, Virilio is already stated by McLuhan, not as elaborately as those guys. They're more literary, right? They're great writers, those guys.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you go into some of the phrasing that they put some McLuhan ideas to, and it's good. I mean, you learn new things.
That's right. I call them broke spirals. They do enhance and extend McLuhan. But if you don't know that it came from McLuhan, you get lost or you don't appreciate the bigger importance. Now, what none of them do is Finnegan's Wake. See, that's where Don Thiel has the edge in the long run. He's an expert on Finnegan's Wake, and that's the hidden ground of McLuhan, as well as Wyndham Lewis. And Baudrillard and them don't do Finnegan's Wake. And when the Internet comes in the late 90s, Finneganese is the best way to describe what's going on in the world with the Internet. Mm-hmm. Not what Foucault says, not what Deleuze and Guattari. They get bogged down with their univocal, in fact, they only talk in one language, in English or French. Mm. You see, it's too univocal. Anyways, that's...
About Le Discours, because I've been reflecting on that. First of all, I had a very interesting experience with Foucault, which is worth mentioning.
Yeah, let's hear it.
The only time I met him was on the footsteps of Emmanuel College in at the University of Toronto. That's part of Victoria College. And Emmanuel College, I think, must have been at one time dedicated to seminarists, or in any case, there was an auditorium there, and there were several lectures given, and one of them was given by Foucault.
Well, this would have to be before about he dies in 1984, so you're talking...
It's probably 82, 83, something like that. He died very soon after.
Right, yeah.
Maybe a year after, or 18 months. I don't know. I can't remember. I have not, like you, a very good memory of dates, faces, names, whatever.
Well, would David Olson have made you aware of the lecture, since he was running the Semiotics newsletter, I think, around that time?
No, he wouldn't. David wasn't running the Semiotics. Was David running the Semiotics?
At some point, yes, in the 80s. Maybe it was after he left the center in 86. But anyways, I'm just thinking there might have been a connection.
Yeah, it must have been after, because the guy who was running it was this wonderful fellow from Victoria as well, Marcello Danesi.
Yes, I know who you mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so
anyway,
you see Foucault.
So here he is, he's coming down, and it's after a very bright lecture on the meaning of autobiography, using Augustine and the Confessions as one of the prime example of what autobiography means, at which point I buttonhole him and say, well, you've said everything that one should, but there's one thing missing, is the aspect of graphy. You certainly have brought out the subjecthood and all the manners of describing yourself, but you said nothing about the fact that all of it is written.
Right.
And then he looks at me puzzled and says, "What are you talking about?" And I say, "Well, I am a schoolboy from the school of McLuhan, and for me the medium is the method." "Oh yeah." "Well, I've never got my head around that one."
That's all. He just says, "Oh yeah, you fit a category," and he doesn't want to discuss it. That's as far as he gets.
And that's very French. I mean, they all do that. I was snubbed away by Derrida in the same fashion.
Right.
But I'll never forget that this man, who basically brought attention to the, you could say he was a grammarian like McLuhan to a certain extent, because Le Discours, he presented it as a grammar of behavior.
Yeah.
And a format of formatting of behavior using, obviously, language. But what's interesting about the discovery of the discourse, and this is where I come in, as opposed to simply repeating McLuhan.
Yeah.
What happened, although I'm always repeating McLuhan, of course, but I come in here by saying what happens is that le discours has known three stages. One of them is expressed, orally, externalized, and not archived. The second one is internalized. It's the appearance of writing, and then particularly of the alphabetic writing. We know all that, and that's part of my alphabet in the brain. Once it's internalized, it reorganizes the whole of psychology and sensibility. But the thing that the discourse not reveals, but simply confirms, is that in the era of electricity, language is outside again, and controlling bodies, whereas in the oral society, it controlled bodies and there was nothing, no resistance to it. In literate societies, it's the body that controls language. It's the reverse of power.
Right.
But right now, with electricity and with all the stuff that's known about us, the big data and all these things that are circulating, and, you know, from WikiLeaks to Snowden, what we're looking at is a discourse. We are looking at language recovering possession of bodies.
You mean verbal language, logocentric?
Oh no, language. The principle of language can be verbal, written,
gestural,
trumpeted.
Gestural.
Well, I'm thinking more of linguistic forms, because it is the articulation of linguistic forms that take control of things. And so what I'm looking at now is, in this present society, that language once again, the dominant language once again is the external language and not the internal one, and that external language is now globalized, and it actually takes possession of bodies.
Are you saying what McLuhan called the word makes the market?
Not right, not quite.
See,
no.
You're saying that the word, I don't see the univocal retaking control. I think that we see that anything that's dated has no staying power. And it's that tactile mud swamp that we live in, a perpetual change, that is what's controlling people.
No, it's true. And there are some very nice, there is a part about the unconscious, which I found very interesting, which I believe comes from, is it from Baudrillard? Or is it from, it's Foucault. When Foucault talks about the unconscious, let me get back to it, and I'll read it to you, because it's exciting.
Is this a quote that I have, or
No, it's a quote you have.
You've got the article up there? You can see it?
Yeah, no, I'm online again.
Okay.
So, where is it? It's about the unconscious. And
all right.
It describes the unconscious. It's not collective, and it's not individual, because it's not the same. It's the unconscious of structural forms of the discourse that underlines behavior and underlines the way things are done. And it's very general. It's a very pervasive kind of thing.
I think I have the quote here. Let's try this.
Here, I've got it.
This is from Foucault Live. That would be a semiotext. Right. So it starts out very schematically. You want to start there? Very schematically is what I see.
Yeah. I was really very schematically consistent trying to discover in the history of science and of human knowledge, des connaissances et du savoir humain, something that would be like, it's unconscious. And then he goes down saying, it cannot be an individual unconscious.
It's not the unconscious of science, of knowledge.
That's right. And yet neither is it a collective unconscious, which would be a kind of collection or a reservoir of archetypes at the disposition of everyone. The structural unconscious is neither of these things. And what he says is a structural, and that's the right term. It is a patterning of behavior by the state of things.
That's right. And he's calling it episteme or episteme.
Yes, episteme, yeah.
Episteme. That is the medium. He's being McLuhan right there, and he doesn't know it. He's trying to point out the medium.
Which is what I was making that story a reference to.
Right.
The story about me meeting him is he simply ignores the medium.
That's right. Even though he is looking at it with a visual bias, he's seeing the figure in the ground relationship and trying to describe it, but ignoring the fact that McLuhan already did it.
Yeah, no, it's true. But it's also the reason why I wanted to ask you a question about this was that I was wondering what real contact there had been between McLuhan and any one of them. I know that McLuhan had read The Archaeology of Knowledge.
Yes, you know how we know that? That's in the foreword to Subliminal Seduction by William Key. Remember Key?
Yes, of course, Brian Wilson Key.
Yeah, and in the foreword there, he quotes The Archaeology of Knowledge, and that's 72, so he knows of Foucault as soon as the book comes out.
Yes, and they may even have been in communication. I'm not sure, though.
Yeah, I talked to a professor friend in New York, and he said, no, there was no contact, you know, between Foucault and McLuhan. I mean, his friend said that. I mean, McLuhan may have written him, but Foucault probably didn't write back.
It could be. It could very well be. But in any case, there was interest in The Archaeology of Knowledge, and we did discuss some of its contents, I remember, with Marshall.
And he also read Derrida, and he called Derrida a manipian. The point is, Marshall would read these guys, and he would recognize that they were trying to get at what he talked about. He could see that. He may not have told his students or had a chance to write to anybody, but they were starting to surface, right? So they were the new people that he had to take pot shots at. He was always aware of what he was reading. A lot of William Burroughs at that time too, and monitoring him. But the thing is that Severo Lestrange with the New York School of Mediacology, and I don't consider Neil Postman the New York School. I consider, just to explain Act 4, which you may not have read, I call it the diasporic school of mediacology, and that's you, Logan, Bruce Powell, Neil Postman, a couple other guys, all get your own book contracts. You're on your own, and you drop back in the center, and you're not really relating to Barry Nevitt or anything that's going on back in Toronto. So you guys, what I call the diasporic, all influenced by McLuhan, but go on and carve out your own spaces. I mean, Bruce goes on to carve out his space as a writer, right?
Mm-hmm.
So Why am I saying that? So the
What I did was to just simply play out both of my drives, the McLuhan passion for the present and percepts and intuitions, insights, marvelous look on my own reality.
Yeah.
But I also came from the Cartesian school, which required that whenever you made a very big statement, you had to have some kind of proof for it. And so that's what I set out to do, the alphabet in the brain. It wasn't really even to get published. It was just to find out. I eventually did get published, but it was not, that was not the purpose of the work. The purpose of the work was to respond to this question: why are we the way we are?
Right.
And then it also, I've often said the story, and I can tell it to you as well. It also came from a flip in my own life, which was completely thanks to McLuhan. Once I was married already, and I couldn't finish my thesis, and I absolutely hated writing it. It was just a horrible experience. And my left hand was pushing my right hand to simply write the first 15 pages of it. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
So I was in a state of desperation, and McLuhan found me that way in the coach house, with my head between my hands. And
what year is that? Is that 70, 71?
That was, it would have been 73.
But you heard Barry and them talking, and him talking about the tetrad. That would be 73 then, you heard them.
Yeah, but I was there often, in 72 and 73.
Oh, all right. So you, before Marshall found you in this condition, you already were experiencing him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I see. Okay.
It was tragic.
Right.
Anyway, so what he said, you look grim. Well, yeah, I'm leaving the university. And he said, well, you're not going to do such thing. And I said, absolutely, I can't write another word of my thesis, and if I don't finish my PhD, I won't keep my job. And he said, well, now, wait a minute, why are you not finishing your PhD thesis? I said, well, because it bores me horribly. And he said, well, do you know what you're looking for? And I said, I suppose. He said, well, no, you don't, because if you knew, you wouldn't be bored.
Mm.
And we said, one is never bored when one knows what one is looking for, and far from it. So then he said, let's see what you're looking for. So I watched the thesis. He never, you know, he was not personal. He wouldn't get into you at all. He was like, couldn't
That's
bother
right.
with you.
That's right.
Generally. But at that time he did. So he said, well, what's the thesis topic? I said, the topic is the causes of the decadence of tragic art in 18th century France. And he said, there's your problem. Said, what's the problem? He said, you call tragedy art. I said, what is it? He said, well, it's not an art form. It's a means to resolve a problem. And I said, what's the problem? The problem is quid. I call it quid, quest for identity.
Wow.
And I said, No, wait, I'm not finished. And he said, tragedy was invented by the Greeks. Well, I said, I know that. He said, yeah, but it was invented for a purpose. It was to mend the broken psyche of Greek society once it had been taken over by the alphabet. And he said, the alphabet created havoc in traditional laws and self-image and image of the other and all these things. He didn't quite describe it the way I'm describing it to you, but that's what he meant in his words. And so people had lost their identity, and so they had to recover it, and tragedy was a means by which they were doing that. Well, to believe it or not, 4 months later, my thesis was done, 450 pages of it. So obviously, things had turned around.
Right. Now, when he said that, did you get a flash, an insight right away?
Yes, I did.
Right. And then you knew what to...
I was trained... By that time, I was trained enough to actually connect right away.
Right.
You know, it was like literally a door and a key.
Right.
And so you open that door, rush through it, and I never looked back. I mean, that's exactly the way I am now. I'm still doing that. I'm not writing that book, but I'm, you know, right... I am totally fascinated by what's going on. It is continuously more fascinating as more and more things happen. I don't buy it. I mean, I don't sell it either. I'm just ob- observing it, and I'm perfectly happy to continue doing it.
Okay, let me explain about the school, why you're the diasporic school. And I'm saying Neil Postman is not the New York School of Media College. It's the Sever Latrunje, and he gets on out in the Global Theater before Neil does with Amusing Yourselves to Death about 1985. Mm-hmm. And so that I have describing it. I go, in the second half of the 80s, there appeared graduates from the Toronto School of Media College, and I include William Irwin Thompson in this, who attempted to preserve the liberal encyclopedic humanist features that they perceived in McLuhan's discoveries. Generally, what they had in common was a rejection of the multimedia comprehensivist themes from the Toronto School that Barrington Nevitt emphasized, as you guys, the diasporic school, wrestled with the question of the relevance of literate, generalist, or multi-specialist values in the electronic maelstrom. The diasporic school celebrated the assumptions and benefits of the Gutenberg galaxy. That's why you, Logan, Postman, Powell, Thompson wrote books, right? Mm-hmm. So you're trying to relate back and see what a book can do. And so you're celebrating the assumptions and benefits of the Gutenberg galaxy while cautiously recognizing, because of a McLuhan school suspicion towards the former Gutenberg disservices, trying to recognize the opportunities for the renewal of humanist ideals presented by the Marconi galaxy. This school was indifferent to McLuhan's disgust with the sectarian conflicts that humanism necessarily evoked, because it genuinely believed the struggles over cultural content were nutritious and invigorating. The school lacked the detachment that McLuhan encouraged towards technological content that led to McLuhan's example, and then I go into McLuhan quote. But the point is, you guys still deal with cultural content. Even Thompson calls his media ecology cultural ecology, right? He goes for content.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what the diasporic school is. People still writing books and not so dismissal of the form level. Actually dismissing the form and not going as far as McLuhan did and trying to retrieve literate content to write books about. That's what I'm saying to diasporic. Now, Baudrillard and the New York School aren't like that. They write books, but they're using whatever they can get. I mean, Baudrillard's going into photography.
Mm-hmm.
Deleuze and Guattari, they're all over. They're political. Virilio's running, trying to create a museum of accidents. And, you know, they are not trying to be, they're good writers, but they're not focusing on retrieving Gutenberg values.
I suppose it all depends on how you phrase it, because what my interest was really to unearth. I mean, I was totally Cartesian with my writing.
That's what I mean. You keep saying you're Cartesian. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
I set out to be that because that was the way I was trained. But eventually, I think I adopted a much more complementary approach via.
Oh yeah, you all did. You all in a way. I mean, Bruce's constant theme is, why am I writing a book? That's what he writes about. You know, I don't know why I keep wanting to write a book. Thompson does that. You do it. You're trying to keep the. It's like, right, well, we need one more book. Even though it's useless, let's make one more book.
That could very well be.
Right. And you see, Croker does something differently. Now, he's the third school. He comes out of Montreal, and he is actually retrieving the McLuhan meme in relation to Sever Latrunje. He comes in to be in any environment to the New York School of Media Ecology.
Mm-hmm.
He absorbs Baudrillard and everybody and goes further. Now, he has to say that McLuhan's not relevant anymore, and he puts down McLuhan. Now, I have to say, he has retrieved McLuhan. He has now taken the part of McLuhan that he said wasn't there, and that made that part of his new book. And he's invented the idea of the dark tetrad. You might want to look at that, his new book, Exits to the Post-Human Future, I think it's called. Just a new book. And he's invented the dark tetrad. But anyways, he's not interested in literate values, what I'm saying you and the diasporic school are doing. He is just basically trying to survive as a panic phenomenon, right? The panic encyclopedia.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So he pushes Baudrillard and Virilio, and he writes brilliantly on them, but he goes past them. And I eventually heard that Baudrillard got fed up with the Crokers. I never had that confirmed, but that's the rumors. But Croker was even too much for Baudrillard.
Yeah. I had several, usually very nice meeting with Croker. a very interesting person. Met him in many of conferences where I in various parts of the world. We used to sort of accidentally be at the same round table or something like that.
Right, because that would be because you were a figure in the art world, and so was he, more than, say, Logan. Logan doesn't get invited to the Viennese Biennale or these things. You and Coker do. And so you would show up in the same. You're actually a more borderline between, you could say, the third school and the fourth school, because you interacted with the Severe, you know, the second school of New York, more than Logan and Thompson did, or Bruce Powell.
Mm-hmm.
You knew those people early. What did you think when you had Baudrillard at your conference in the 83-84 in Paris?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Remember you did that? I think Don Peel was there. What did you think of, what did you as a McLuhanite think of his writings?
I thought it was very illuminating, very clear. And they were, especially in La Société de Communication, that was De Consommation, rather, there was a lot of things that were very redolent of McLuhan, I would say. He's the only one I suspect to have actually really read McLuhan.
Yes. Yeah.
The other ones, I don't think.
Well, his first writing, supposedly, is his review of either The Medium as a Massage or Understanding Media in 1967. That's his first article in 1967 in France.
That I didn't know. How wonderful. That's the thing about you. You are an absolutely enlightened archivist.
That's right. That's exactly. And I actually personally met Baudrillard in 1972. I have my encounter with him in my diaries that are published on my site.
Well,
but
here's one for you about Baudrillard. I've had several meetings with Baudrillard, and one of the most amusing was going up on the CN Tower and going there invited by the French embassy or consulate writer to keep company to Baudrillard.
Mm.
And Baudrillard was also, along with another friend of mine who's just wonderful, Paolo Fabbri, who is was a professor in Bologna and who's now retired, but an absolutely delightful person. And Fabbri and Baudrillard were friends. And Baudrillard also had a girl there, a young woman, which kind of was his girl, but anyway, it was a young woman who came from, I believe, Hamilton.
Yeah.
You may have known who she was. Anyway, she was a Canadian friend of Baudrillard who was with us, but I forgot her name. And so we go to the restaurant of that tower, and as you may know, the restaurant has a circular rotation movement. So Baudrillard, and the food is a smorgasbord, so you help yourself at the center of the pylon, and then you go back to your place. The only thing is your place has left.
Yes.
And I saw panic in the eyes of Baudrillard, wondering where his table was, and I said, "Don't worry, it'll come back." So that's his first spatial experience that makes him uneased.
That's a North American experience.
It wasn't his first American experience. But, I mean, he'd been traveling in virtual reality far before.
Yeah, but that's a unique one. He didn't get that on the Eiffel Tower, does he? You don't. That doesn't rotate.
No,
does
you don't
it?
Have the same thing. So, but then, okay, so then we have lunch. Eventually, I walk him to the table, and we get our lunch. We had a very friendly and excited. You know, we were laughing a lot.
Well, what year is this? You know, 80s, 90s?
Don't ask the questions like this. It would be...
Is it like during Olsen time when you're working with him?
It's absolutely during Olsen time. Yeah.
David Olsen. So yes. David is the director. So that's before 86, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right.
No,
okay.
David gave up in 90.
Okay, 90. So so he is director.
It would have been around closer to... David was still director, yes, I think he was.
Right, okay, so then we have an idea who was in the 80s.
Well, we were co-director.
That's right.
That's another story for you. That's lots of stories.
Right. But that's a way for you to remember where
but
you...
of course it does. Yeah. But I'm not finished with Baudrillard, by no means. So you know that at the bottom level of that circular thing, of the CN Tower, there is a thick slate of glass, a thick pan of glass.
Yes.
And you see 300 meters below, you know.
Yeah.
And you walk above it, and you walk above emptiness. Well, we bring Baudrillard there. Baudrillard takes one look at this, becomes green, and I can't go through this. I had to give Baudrillard my hand and let him make him go across that chasm. And what? He was actually on all fours.
Wow.
He was just terrified. So it reminded me right away of a famous statement by Blaise Pascal, the French philosopher,
yeah,
who said, philosophers cannot bear emptiness. If you ask a philosopher to cross a perfectly fine bridge over a precipice, he won't do it.
Wow.
Now, that reminds you also of McLuhan's many often repeated statements about the American Indians who could stand,
yes,
on the high-rise construction sites without any kind of fear or vertigo, because they didn't connect the vanishing line. They didn't know anything about the vanishing line.
That's
all
right.
They needed was the equilibrium and something under their feet.
No, that's right.
Pascal said that.
Yeah, McLuhan writes about Pascal being, you know, he represented the post-Newtonian world where the universe, the dark, empty spaces opened up. And this was terrible. This infinity was a dark chasm that put fear in people of Pascal's time. And he articulated that. Isn't that what you're referring to?
Le silence, c'est l'espace infini.
Right, right.
Silence of this infinite space.
Now, here's what's interesting. If you look at page 136 of Cliché d'Archétype, he gives the sensory bias of each culture because they express what he called plenary awareness in mm-hmm. some phrase. Like the British say, I know it like the back of my hand. So that's visually biased. You translate
Spanish,
the book.
As if I gave it birth.
As if I had given birth to it. That's proprioceptive. And
that's
the French say, I know it au fond, but that's acoustic. So what's interesting, you've got the French are visually biased like the British, but they have this acoustic aspect that the British don't have, which is...
Now,
let me give you my instant theory about this, is that that's why Derrida says writing is pre-speech, right? Writing is prime. Because under tactile global theater, everybody goes east, becomes the opposite. East goes west, west goes east. Well, the acoustic French go visual, and the visual British go acoustic. So the British produce the Beatles and punk rock, and Derrida is produced by the French, where they go hyper, retrieve, visual abstraction. Do you see how they become their opposite?
That's flip.
They flip. Within the visual bias of the Western world, you have this difference between the French and the British, and the French are visually biased. I mean, the British are more visual. French are more acoustic. But in the 80s, they become opposite. They flip and put on the opposite. The Derrida is hyper-abstraction, saying that writing is more important than speech, right? That's his whole Andy McLuhan point, is that's him adopting in his panic of trying to hoik up visual space, which he naturally is not. The French are au fond. They're acoustic.
I hope so.
Right.
I hope so. I find the French, I live in France part of the week.
Part of the week in Nice. Are you teaching there?
Yeah. No, I just like the place. And I go there for weekends. I teach in Naples, but I'm going to be through with that this year. And then I'm involved with a magazine called Media Due Mila in Rome. And
what's the name of the magazine?
Media Duemila, Media 2000.
Okay.
It's a magazine about technology, culture, government, and business.
And are you the editor or a contributor?
No, I'm a general, I mean, not an editor, what do you call that, a scientific director of it. I make connections, meet people, invite people to talk, and
you're responsible for that part of the content?
Not only, no, but we also do... We do conferences and things, and we organize conferences and things.
Well, how does that relate to the McLuhan Institute or whatever you guys started? That there's a what is it called? International McLuhan Institute or something. You started that after the centenary year.
No. It's nothing to do with that. That's the International McLuhan Studies.
Right.
It's not an institute. No, it's a journal. It's a yearly book journal that we publish with the help of the University of Barcelona.
Okay, so then that's...
But it's difficult to produce because there's ever less money for things like that, and so we're constantly running, you know, after our own tail, so to speak.
Right. Okay, so let's just go back. Now think of an 81, 82, 83, the only person really being the ghost of McLuhan. We used to say Barry Nevitt was the ghost of McLuhan. So just see this. You've got Barry Nevitt first. You would agree with that. There's no Cervera Trenche.
Sure.
There's none of these Cimatex guys happening until 83, 84. Then by the middle 80s, people are interested in what they're writing.
Mm-hmm.
And then you see Croker shows up in the late 80s, and he sparks a scene. I remember Cervera Lattrenzi telling me that when he first met Arthur Merriluise at some conference in 89 out in Idaho or someplace, he said they were like termites coming out of the woodwork. I don't know where they came from. But that's because there was a level of satire or of going beyond what Cervera had done with his French theory boys. And here's Arthur Merriluise going further with the Panic Encyclopedia. So they're a new figure.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have Wired magazine, which retrieves McLuhan for the virtual world, the internet world, the unique quality of the media in the 90s. And that's when you and Logan and Bruce Powell, William Irwin Thompson, a lot of you guys get book contracts because McLuhan is people are interested in McLuhan again, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks to the Wired magazine.
Yes, I guess that must have been part of the case, yeah. But it was also because people were desperate. I mean, the media were desperate. They just didn't know how to interpret things. They needed to have people who would express what was going on in various aspects of their own work and of technological transformations. Things were actually happening all the time. And I think... I have always had the feeling, wherever I've been, in these conferences or responding to interviews or dealing with, that there was a genuine desire to understand more, but there was a lot of ground to cover before you got there.
Right.
There has been, during my whole professional life, a sense of being called to respond to questions that I was interested in myself.
Say it again. There was a sense in all your life that there was a public concern about what you were interested in.
Yes.
I see. Yeah.
But with less, but dimly. It was dim, but you couldn't shake it.
Right.
As if the public was being stuck with it and wanted to know more because it couldn't get rid of it. It would have rather gotten rid of it, but it couldn't.
That's right. It kept coming back.
Yeah.
And they would wonder why McLuhan kept showing up. In some
exactly.
way.
Exactly. And McLuhan was considered gradually more and more relevant and pertinent and correct. Right now, I don't know if you've seen what's happening with the Coach House, but there is going to be some kind of conference going on there.
Yes, I saw the... I'm on the list there. I saw that, Donald Gillies wanted to say, he's right, you know, the big sign on the Coach House. And Michael Evans said, what if he's right? But no, it's he's right now, right?
He's right.
Correct. But that brings up the point I told you before we start recording. I want us to, in our dialogues here, to move towards proving how McLuhan is not relevant for people to understand the world today.
All right. Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Now, right now, it's dinner time, and I'm going to have to leave you. So what we should do then is I will work at that. And we can talk again, I don't think tomorrow or after tomorrow, but something over the weekend.
Okay, good. And the read the rest of the long essay, become familiar with the other schools, and we'll see what they did as closet McLuhanites, making sure they didn't say they were McLuhan, and where the obsolescent McLuhan hides in the shadows or not. That's what I want to work at. So great.
All right. Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Derek.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Bye.